Hey everyone, and welcome to the Scientist Podcast. We're so excited to have our guest on today. So much so that we've deviated just slightly from the usual rule of predominantly speaking to scientists. Our guest today received her PhD in history in 2012, and has since set up a career coaching business called From PhD to Life. She's an expert in working with graduate students as they transition to careers outside of academia, and on top, she writes an incredibly popular blog. I'm so excited to welcome Dr. Jennifer Polk. Dr. Polk, thank you so much for being here.
Sure. Thank you so much, Jamie. And please, everyone, call me Jen. It's the regular way.
Okay, well, Jen, to kick off, can you characterize the predicament that graduate students find themselves in when, say, they're coming towards the end of a dissertation and find that they're not totally enamored with academia?
Yes, that's a great question. So I'll generalize here, but a predicament for many people is that they have been on this path and where what seems like a clear-ish a road to a career and a life. And if they are not enamored of it anymore, or if it is not so much available to them in a way that fits all of their other parameters and needs for life, then what else? And occasionally for some folks, there is a more or less clear what else. But for a lot of folks, there isn't. Yeah, there's a lot of variety there, but sometimes there really isn't, because the thing that you studied, the thing that you became an expert in, does not exist outside of academia in any direct way, And so, oh shit, what else? What now?
Well, on that, something that I read you quoted that blew me away was something by Lisa Boulanger. She said, and I'm quoting, "No one, and I mean no one, cares if you got publications or not." Now that was a wild thing to read. I kind of have this idea, like lots of people do, I imagine, that, well, if you have a PhD, that means you're really, really clever. And if you're really, really clever, that means you're employable. And having publications is some significant indication of that cleverness, but that's not quite how it's perceived.
Yeah, her point was, and I make this point a lot too, I mean, you know, of course, there's always nuance. And yeah, sure, some employers might be interested in your publications, but I think the general point is really important. And one manifestation of that point is when you're writing a non-academic resume, putting an application in for a job that is beyond the tenure track, probably you're not going to include your publications. You might make reference to your publications as a means of explaining particular experience and skills and accomplishments as relevant, but you're probably not going to have any list of publications in the way that you totally will on an academic CV. That's really important on your academic CV, because what your employer is hiring you for outside of academia is probably not to produce academic journal articles. That is probably not what they care about. So yeah, you're probably going to, that's probably the first thing you're going to do on that document is not put in all your conference papers. You're not going to put in all your publications. You're going to delete all of that stuff. And it's really wild. I think, Jamie, your reaction to that. Yeah, it's a real mind scratcher for a lot of people. But yeah, probably your employer is not going to care.
Which is strange, right? Because when you're in academia, before you make the transition, all people care about to some degree is your publications and your citations. It must be a slightly wild thing to turn around and go, nope, delete. To zoom out just slightly, there's two questions I'm interested in asking. The first is, what exactly is it that you do? And the second is, how did you find yourself doing it?
Right, okay. So these days, and I'm talking to you in the beginning of November 2020. So these days, I am fully self-employed and I'm just me. So I don't have any staff or contractors. Me and software and the cat. And I have clients, so individual clients, and I have group clients, and primarily I'm coaching them and some consulting. So consulting, the quick way of saying that is I give advice, and the coaching is I ask you questions and you end up giving yourself advice. So I'm in that kind of space. There's a spectrum there. So individual services. And then the other way that I make money, a different income stream for me, is I give talks and deliver workshops, often for universities, professional associations or research institutes or individual departments, whatever. But those are my two main income streams these days. I've done different things over the years, but it's all related to you have a PhD and now what? And I do have a sub-niche of self-employed PhD, which I know you know about. So I do work a lot with folks that are in graduate school, that are no longer in graduate school, and also folks that have their own businesses, usually people that have PhDs. So that's what I do now. how I got into this. Was that your question, how I originally got into this?
Yeah, it was sort of a double whammy.
Yeah, so how I originally got into this. So the backstory is that I finished my PhD in 2012, and I graduated the summer of 2012, history PhD. And I, what now? So very at the beginning, I was freelancing because I had been freelancing already. And so I just continued to do that. But early on, I started working with a career coach. This is Hillary Hutchinson. I always talk about her. Her website is transitioningyourlife.com. And she introduced me to the world that is coaching, life coaching, really. And so I worked with her intensively for a few months, and I was intrigued. And I took some coaching courses eventually. I took one coaching class to learn these skills. And it was in that context that I started to have my own clients. I'm kind of making a longer story very short, but my first client was about a year after I graduated, so summer of 2013. And at that point, there was no big strategic plan in place for having my own business. It just sort of happened. And that was 7 years ago, more than 7 years ago. And yeah, done different kinds of things over the years, but mostly all around, what do you do after your PhD? It's been fun.
How does it feel having a client for the first time? So I could do the coaching. I know now that I'm a life coach in a specific area, and up to your door rocks Mr. or Mrs. somebody. And they say, I think I want some coaching. How is that for you?
Yeah, so for me, it was really important that I had some training around this. So how do you structure a coaching call, coaching conversation? All of the work that I have done has been virtual. It's often phone or Zoom. In the beginning, a few years, we would never have our cameras on because I was trained to do it just audio only. And even now, often people like to have the cameras on, and that's cool with me. But usually I look directly at the camera, so I still don't even really see my clients, right? Because I'm not looking at them. I think if you understand what I mean these days. Yeah, so for me, having that framework that I was taught and had I learned through experience was really important. And I respect that framework. And over the years, you know, I do deviate, and every client is different. But yeah, you know, I think in the beginning, I was very upfront with clients. Like, everyone knew, you know, that I was in training, that I was new, that I wasn't charging them very much in the very beginning. So, I think everybody was comfortable with everything.
What's the general reaction in academia tend to be when someone says they want to do something slightly different? Say you've done the first 3 years of a PhD, and you're coming to the last 6 months. And you're kind of wanting to express that, hey, academia isn't exactly the thing I'm wanting to do. Are people receptive to that? Or is there kind of a feeling of, oof, good luck?
All of the above. All of the above. And, you know, I come from Canada, and our PhDs are a little longer here. So, anyways, I started my PhD in 2004. So it took me a while to finish. What is the reaction? Really all the above. I'm sighing because there are still stories even now of people feeling totally ostracized and knowing that they really can't talk about their advisor about having thoughts because they know that they will be perceived as betraying them in some way. Betraying, you know, in their intellectualism, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, sort of abandoning science, all of that bad stuff. On the other hand, lots of professors are fully aware that academia is not all it's cracked up to be. And, you know, even if there are pockets of awesomeness, there's only small area. There's not enough jobs for all of the people that want those jobs. And so there's really a big variety in reactions that you could get. I would like to think that it is less dire than people think, and I, you know, maybe, but all of the above is true.
That must be really scary, actually, coming to the end of something and working with someone so closely, like your PhD advisor, and not being able to say, oh, this isn't the career for me.
Yes, absolutely. I had a client years ago, and she was so worried about the reaction of these women who were, not only were they her PhD advisors, her professors that she had worked with and collaborated with over the years, but she really saw them as kind of deep life mentors. people that she was really close with. And she was so nervous about how they would react. And the shift that she made, and it, you know, it wasn't like a snap your fingers kind of shift. It took time, was if they were really there for her and really wanted her to have a good future, that they would support her, even if they couldn't understand the specifics of her new vision for her future, her emerging vision. And she found actually that, you know, once she got up the courage to speak with some of them about this, that they did in fact support her. I think it does, it brings up things for certain supervisors. In Canada, we usually call them supervisors. In the US, advisors, chairs, whatever, directors. But that person, you know, sometimes it can bring up things for them personally that have totally nothing to do with you. And in some cases, your PI, your supervisor's career is implicated in your choices. So, you know, there, it is a bit of a messy, sticky situation. But ultimately, it's your life, it's your career, and you've got to do what you've got to do.
Oh, so in some cases, your professors or your supervisors are implicated directly in your decision. How so?
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to emphasize that too much, but on some grant applications, there's sometimes a space for you to report where your trainees, quote unquote, have gone on to, and you can get points for that kind of stuff. There are some antiquated evaluations and assessments for profs where that stuff comes into play.
Okay, so it's on the margins in applications for grants, etc.
Yeah, I'm not an expert on this, but you know, it's definitely a complicated situation, which can make things difficult for your supervisors to be impartial. I mean, they're not impartial; they're evaluating you, right? They're evaluating you.
I'm fascinated by your process here as a coach. So to play this out in a very simple reductionist way, if I came to you and said, look, academia isn't for me, I've come to the end of a PhD process, and I don't really know what I want to do, where would you kind of start?
Aha. So I'm laughing. The first thing I would say is, well, what do you want to do, Jamie? What do you want to do?
So say I've looked around a bit, but I'm just not so sure what I want to do at this point.
Yeah, right. So you would say some version of, I don't know, or I'm not sure. And okay. And I'd say, well, that's okay. Tell me what you do know about it. Tell me what you do know about it. Be vague. What does it smell like? What does it taste like? You know, be vague. So for, you know, that's the first question I want to hear from folks is, you know, yeah, what do you actually want to do in life? You know, who do you want to hang out with? What kind, you know, do you want to sit at a desk? Do you want to walk around? Right? I mean, I don't mean to be simplistic, but tell me what you want to do and forget job titles, forget company names, forget even work sectors. Just tell me what you want to do. And we start from there. And in general, my framework for this kind of stuff is, without, if I didn't know anything about you, and obviously, you know, I work with individuals usually, so everyone is different. But as a general framework, it's first figure out yourself. What's important to you? What do you value? What do you like doing? What are your skills? What are your strengths? All of that good stuff. It's self-reflection. You can do assessments. But yeah, just, you know, answer those questions for yourself. That's step one. I'm making this like a clear, you know, step-by-step process. The reality, of course, is messy, but anyways, well, pretend that it's clear. So who are you? What do you want? What's out there? That's step two, right? What's out there? So that's when you're, okay, you're going to read job ads. You're going to read people's LinkedIn profiles. You're going to read company career websites. You're going to read blog posts that talk about what data science is. So you're going to learn what's out there. And then crucially in that, you're also going to be doing informational interviews. That's when you talk with folks about what they do and how they got into this and what the culture is like in their company and what the field in general is like, et cetera, depending on what you want to know. So that's knowing what's out there. And then the third big category here is continued networking. Maybe you narrow things down so that you can network a little more strategically and selectively, and applying for jobs, again, strategically and selectively. So my point in laying out this step-by-step process is that there's a lot to do before you ever get to applying for a job, potentially. And ideally, you start all of this early. It's not always the case in reality, but ideally, you know, you start early.
So I'd love to take those one by one, because you make a really interesting point about introspection. And to make this a conversation just briefly about human behavior, I love the idea that what energizes you, who you want to hang out with, whether you want to be indoors or outdoors, etc., etc., effectively acts as a feedback mechanism for your experiences. And a feedback mechanism that says, well, this is a little bit more aligned for me, this is a little bit less aligned. And you've spoken explicitly here about being energized. What's the role of remembering or recalling times you've been energized in figuring out what it is that you want to do?
Oh my goodness, yes. I mean, I assume that we all want to do work that we can be engaged in, that we can find meaningful, that has impact for us, that's a bit fun, right? That we can show up as our full selves. And so that when, and the moments from your past where you're feeling energized, whatever context that came in, those give you clues into the types of work that are really engaging and meaningful. And when you feel really successful, so engaged or when you feel successful, I mean, these are different concepts, but they're kind of related. So examples that I would give for my own, when I do this exercise for myself, is one of the things that was really energizing for me was organizing conferences and workshops and lecture series, et cetera. I was really keen on this stuff when I was in graduate school. You know, this wasn't part of my job as a graduate student, but it's something that I went out of my way to do. Okay, that tells you something about me, right? As opposed to other people in the department who didn't go out of their way to do this. So then I would reflect on, okay, what specific bits of this were energizing to me, right? And then, okay, another thing that I found really energizing was going to the archives. Well, what about the archives? What about the archives? Was it the travel? Yeah, not so much in my case. But it was actually reading letters and diaries, reading first-person accounts. That was what I found most exciting. Well, what does that say about me, right? So at the end of the day with this exercise, you draw lessons about strengths, about values, about kind of core interests. And the conclusion is, well, I should work as an archivist. That's really not the conclusion. The conclusion from that insight for me turned out to be, well, I'm really interested in people, actual people that are alive and what they're doing and what they're thinking, what they're feeling, what the stories they're telling. So that's one connection. Oh, life coach. Huh. Right? It would be totally the wrong thing for some other history PhD out there. But for me, it made sense. And let me draw the example from, I loved organizing events. Oh, huh. Well, one of the things that I've done a lot of in my career since my PhD is frankly organizing events. I've put on online conferences. I've set up workshops. I've organized drop-in sessions these days for self-employed PhDs, right? So it's a very different context in which I'm doing all of this work. But the core interest, the core thing that I just go out of my way to do is still there. Does that make sense?
Yeah, and it's a lovely nuance, because someone else who also gets going off archiving might decide they want to be a librarian or sort through these types of documents. And that's what makes human behavior so fascinating, that two people can draw at times diametrically opposed conclusions from the exact same experience.
Yeah, and it makes me think that this is why it is a mess, right? I mean, to use that metaphor, you know, when you're shoveling shit, right? When you're shoveling in the dirt, it's necessarily messy. It is necessarily messy. And the same thing with figuring out what kind of career you want. And it's not a math equation. It's not that you input all of this data and then it spits out after, you know, it does all the calculating, it spits out your one ideal career. That is not what is going to happen, but that you're going to come up with a suite of possibilities and you're going to be in conversation with the folks that you want to be in conversation with. And at one point, something is going to align and you're going to get into a job and then you're going to get into a different job, right? And then you're going to make shifts within and without and make changes and you're going to navigate and build and create a career for yourself that is in alignment with you that you could never, I mean, it's going to be messy, but it's all going to make sense for you in the end.
Yeah, and it's a funny comparison that between the theory, which is, well, this is in very basic terms the principles of how we're going to work, and life, which is messy. And what I imagine you end up with is transitions and progress that aren't linear, etc. Is that a difficult part of your job? Kind of having to say to people, well, you need to keep on trying here because we're going down the right path, but things aren't always going to be aligned all of the time straight away.
I mean, sometimes I say to people, well, what if you were in fact doing everything right? Mm. I mean, right? Sometimes I say that to people and they're like, right? Exactly what your reaction was. Because sometimes the answer is, yeah, it sounds like you're doing everything right. And it just takes time. So relax. And I might not say it quite in those terms, but.
Is there anything of note that's surprising about the process? You know, you did the coaching and then you went in and started helping people. Was there anything that 18 months in you went, oh, wow, I wasn't expecting that to be that way?
So one thing that was surprising early on, which in retrospect isn't, I mean, right, that's how life works, was that I set out to work with people who were like a few steps behind me. So when I started doing this, I was very new in the like, okay, I'm figuring out what's next and I have landed on something and I'm a few months ahead. And that's who I thought that I'd be working with folks who were a few months behind me in the process. And yeah, I did work with those folks and I continue to. And then, but very quickly within the first few months, I also had clients who were coming to me because they wanted to finish their dissertation. They weren't thinking about careers yet. I didn't expect that, right? But that is something that they saw in me that I could help them with. The other example is also very early on. I had a client who was a tenured professor and he wanted assistance with productivity and getting his writing done. And he saw that my skills could help him with that. And I still do some of that work as well. So even though there's a lot of nervousness when you're starting a business around, you know, being too niche, being too narrow in your focus, and that precludes you from working with other types of folks that you might want to work with, actually the benefit of having a really clear niche is people start to see you as an expert and they respect that niche and they might, in fact, come to you even though you're not speaking directly to them. Does that make sense, Jamie?
That makes an immense amount of sense. I think you've just sold the benefits of having a niche really well. Because when people shop around for anything, they think in the first instance, well, where's the best place I can go? And if you're having a niche, well, you're kind of flagging that that's you. Whereas if you're slightly more of a generalist, it may well be you, but it's not so obvious at first meeting. I want to talk a little bit about the role of choice here. Because I think when we're talking about jobs, there's an existential question of choice. Now, whether it's PhD students or anybody else, there's more choice in terms of jobs, at least superficially, than at possibly any point in history beforehand. I mean, I, for instance, could learn Spanish, learn how to fish, and go become a fisherman in Costa Rica, and that could all happen in 6 months. And if you look at relationships, romantic relationships, others, and you look at this relationship with choice, it's interesting. It kind of has the inverse relationship you might expect, because you might think the more choice, like any competitive market, the better the results. But it kind of works the opposite. People with less choice, so that's people in small towns and villages, report higher marriage satisfaction than people in metropolitan cities. And I was just wondering if there's something that could apply here to your work, because your job ultimately is to find people fulfilling work. And clearly, at least in the context of relationships, it's proved harder to find fulfillment when there's so much choice.
Yeah, interesting. I hadn't thought of it in quite these terms before, but something I do think about a lot and talk with people about is that I think that a lot of jobs out there are broadly similar. And so I'm repeating myself to say, this is not an exercise in finding the one true job for you, because that's not a thing. There's a lot of possible jobs. Potentially, there's a lot of possible romantic partners too. I mean, I don't know, let's not talk about that, but there's no one true. There's no dream job, but there's a lot of possibilities. And so it's a matter of getting somewhere that is going to check a bunch of the boxes for you. It's not going to be perfect because nothing is. And you're going to dedicate yourself to doing that for as long a time as, you know, this ain't working and you can shift. Do you shift internally? Is it because your boss sucks? Do you need a different job? Do you need to pivot again, make a huge transition? I mean, who knows? But that you just sort of take it for what it is and you navigate life over time.
No, I think that answers it perfectly. As something of a slight pivot, but something I found super interesting when I was researching this chat, was that you occasionally post transition updates on the people you've worked with. So what are transition updates and why are they so cool?
Yeah, so early on, so I started my business in the summer of 2013, as it turned out. And even before then, in the beginning of in January 2013, I started on my blog, the Transition Q&A series. And I'm less good about contributing to it these days, but transition Q&As are when I get other people to write their stories. And I very quickly developed, I think there's 9 questions and the same questions and almost everyone is exactly the same structure. What did you hope for as you finished your PhD? What was your first post-PhD job? What do you do now? What is most surprising about it? You know, et cetera. And the last question is, what advice do you have for folks navigating this transition nowadays? And so I get other people to write in, and I think now I've got like 70 of them or something like that. They're published on my blog for the first little bit from phdtolife.com. And then subsequently, they're now published on my University Affairs blog. And so those are the original transition Q&A pieces. And then over the years, I've had the same folks come back and contribute transition updates. And so one that I can think of is a guy who his transition Q&A was about how he had worked in a tenure track position for a year, and then he transitioned into a job in a provincial government. This is Jared Wesley I'm thinking of. I don't mean to be cagey. So he talked about, you know, his work in the provincial government, but his transition update was how, well, he went back and got a tenure track job. In fact, tenured job, right? So that was the update. So that I you know, that's a bit of an unexpected update. But yeah, those are fun. I'm less good about soliciting the updates as I could be, but that series, it still goes on. I think it's really fantastic to show the diversity of careers that people go into and all of the individual advice, which is always amazing, that they give for PhDs. Hopefully it makes everyone reading them feel less alone in this.
I think you've stumbled upon something really cool just there, which is, it's very subtle, but you used to be more into posting these things, and now you're a little bit less so. And that's kind of the other piece of the puzzle when people are looking for jobs. Something that interests them initially, and it's energizing and exciting to do, might not be as energizing 6 months down the line. How do you deal with that natural evolution of people's interests?
This is why working outside of academia is so great. And I don't mean to set up a clear dichotomy, because of course, you know, with academic jobs, there's variety in them too, obviously, right? But outside of academia, there's a lot more possibility and there's a lot more variety. And you're not, you know, this stereotype that you're going to teach sociology one-on-one and you're still going to be teaching sociology one-on-one in 40 years. And it, you know, it's not going to change enormously over time. Outside of academia, your career is not going to be like that. It's not going to be like that. And so, I think that's a good thing. I think there's a good thing, and there's an expectation that folks are going to evolve in their careers. And they're going to do different things within the context of the same employer, the same job, the same title, right? They're even going to do different things within that. And if not, they're going to get a different job. And this is normal. It's expected. It's encouraged a lot of the time. And that's fun because, of course, yeah, we grow and we learn and we change and we nerd out about different things over time.
Do you find that people tend to be frustrated by that change? So I guess what I mean is, oh my God, I've got the thing. I found the thing, thank God. And 3 months into the job, you're like, I've started an 18-month contract and this is less fun than it was 3 months ago.
Of course. I mean, how exhausting. I just went through all this shit and now I got to do it again.
Right? Yeah. Right.
Yeah. No, it sucks, but it's, you know, I think once folks get into it, once you sort of, okay, all right, I accept, I allow, right? I allow that the world is going to be what the world is. And you get a plan in place. It doesn't have to be a super involved plan, but you say, okay, I'm going to set a timer and I'm going to spend the next 10 minutes reflecting on what do I truly value now in November 2020? What is really important to me nowadays? And you do that for 10 minutes. You'll feel better, right? So everything, you know, you just do it step by step by step, and then it's not overwhelming and you don't have to be angry about it.
Something that I thought was very cool is this. I read that once upon a time you were knee deep in the Toronto music scene. Did that sort of play in with the academia at all? I ask because academia and a real interest in the Toronto music scene isn't the most common place of crossovers.
Yeah, absolutely. You did your research, Jamie. So during my PhD, the last few years, I was heavily involved in the music scene, but I was not a musician myself. And so I had a blog and a podcast for a couple of years, and I went to a ton of shows. And, you know, I could say a bunch of different things about this, but one thing that I really valued about it was there were people that were really passionate about what they were doing, whether it was the musicians or it was the photographers, the bloggers, the bookers, right, the folks putting things on. I really liked that whole world. I wasn't yeah, I mean, you know, obviously there's, you know, shit in there too, but that I found refreshing, especially as I became more disillusioned, I'm making a face, you know, truth be told, more disillusioned with the academic world. So I liked, and it had nothing to do with academia for me, but it also gave me great clues at the end of the day when I reflected, because I was a community builder, as it turned out. I was a community builder within the context of my academic department, my, you know, my group of grad students and other organizations that I was involved with it within academia and on campus. And as it turned out, I was a community builder in the music scene, because I had a blog and a podcast and a mailing list. And I think I had a Facebook group, I mean, whatever. And so, oh, okay, this was really useful. When it came time to reflect on who I was as a person and what I valued and, you know, what energized me. So it gave me a lot of really interesting insights, even though like it didn't lead directly to a job, right? Same as academia, it didn't lead directly to a job, but it gave me so much great information about myself. And frankly, it was fun. It was really fun and it was cool.
I love that as a tie-in to where we started this conversation, because I'm 23. So a lot of my friends and myself included, we play this game of, what do I want to do? And you kind of have your interests. Everyone has that passion project. But it's not clear that it has anything to do with what you're going to do vocationally. And for instance, you're not a musician or a full-time music blogger. But in goes the shovel and out comes this insight of, I love community building. And now, lo and behold, you know, you're a career coach. And your unique brand, the flavor of your career coaching is, well, I'm going to do lots of talks. I'm going to talk to big groups and I'm going to post updates on how people are getting on. And ultimately, I'm going to go and create that community. So it's a lovely demonstration of how one passion or hobby that doesn't seem directly linked to vocational work is, beyond being quite a lot of fun, a rich treasure trove of insights when it comes to the question of what will I do?
Yeah, and it also explains why I have marketed my business the way that I have. That's kind of a way of putting it, but I like social media. I like hanging out with my people online.
We're so attuned, right? We really know when we show up as our best self. We're kind of built, I think, a little to do that.
It's amazing the extent to which folks can get away from being who they are. Does that make sense? You know, the academic culture can be, and the longer you're in it, you know, if you do a PhD in the humanities in the US or Canada, I mean, I was 32 when I finished and I went straight through high school, BA, MA, PhD, right? No stopping. That is a long time to be in this one culture. I mean, I'm simplifying a little bit, but it is easy for that to kind of take over to a large extent what it is that you value and what do you do. And it can really take you away from what you know about yourself. And so it can be a real challenge and a real like serious project that you got to take on for yourself to kind of take off all of that stuff and think really, okay, but what do I actually value? No, not my advisor, not the journal editor, right? Not my discipline. I don't want, who cares about the discipline? What do you care about? What is important to you? And that, right, it can take a real doing for a lot of people.
Yeah, do you find that people end up having identity crises?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Because academia is an identity. It not for every single person, but it is a, I'm borrowing, it was Kelly Baker who wrote this years ago. She called academia a total culture. It's not quite exactly that, or folks that say over the years, like Karen Kielski will say, academia is a cult. Again, it's not quite true, but there are elements of that. There are elements of that where it's this big monstrous beast that kind of takes over everything. Again, I'm exaggerating a little bit, but yeah, I think it does take some doing. I forgot what you asked me.
No, that was even better. Jen, thank you so much for joining me. I really appreciate it. I feel like I've learned a lot, and I think you do such a fascinating thing. In some ways, given you started off doing a history PhD, but are now kind of a community building career coach, well, you're the perfect demonstration of your message. So thank you so much for coming on. And to everyone listening at home, thank you for being with us. And as always, this has been the Scientist Podcast, and we'll see you next week.